this is Aliska van 't Voort for From the Frontline. With me in the studio is Dr. Peter Hammond, and today we are dealing with Afghanistan, a trial of betrayal. Dr. Hammond, what is currently going on in Afghanistan?
Oh, Aliska, this is very distressing. Most of the Afghan army, when they saw the American military suddenly abruptly abandoning them and pulling out of the Bagram air base, you can understand how that must have been not just very disheartening and morale-breaking, but it was the entire logistical support base, the entire supply chain, their communication system was all centered around Americans, because for 20 years, America's built up the whole Afghan National Army around America being the air support and their communication system and logistical supply. And that's the way they built it. America poured not just billions, they poured over $1 trillion into Afghanistan, much of it in high-tech weaponry. And to suddenly, so abruptly, without even informing the British, the Czech, the Polish, the Australian, the German allies, the French allies who there, they didn't even, the British government have said publicly, we weren't even informed that our allies were pulling out. And we were there in support of our allies, and the Americans pulled out without even telling us. And so at the moment, the French, British, German, Australian, and Czechs are venturing behind enemy lines to rescue their stranded civilians, their citizens. The Americans aren't. The Pentagon and State Department have admitted they don't even know how many Americans are in the country, and they don't know where they are. And their only advice to the people is for the people to travel to the Kabul airport, which is surrounded by the Taliban. They've got roadblocks on the way there. And they say, we can't provide any support or escort for you to get there. But check onto the State Department's Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. And literally, you're on your own kind of attitude, which is staggering. Why would they have closed down Bagram Air Base and withdrawn before all their citizens and civilians were out and before their soldiers were out? Surely, but they pulled out the Army and Air Force first. And then the people, what? You've pulled out and suddenly the Taliban is taking over things. And they overtook most of the country in a space of days. And the debacle is so huge. And when you think about this, that President Biden of America, I'll use the word lightly, President, he was adamant just a few weeks ago that the Taliban will never be able to overrun Afghanistan because Kabul has a well-funded, well-trained army. The Afghan troops of 300,000 are well-equipped as any army in the world. They have an air force against something like just 75,000 Taliban. And I trust the capacity of the Afghan military, better trained, better equipped, more competent in terms of conducting war. Well, it took the Taliban less than 5 weeks to prove Biden wrong and to expose the hypocrisy of America's 20 years of constructive engagement in Afghanistan. Now, in trying to make sense of this, I've had a few of my military friends from America, which includes people who are in intelligence and in special forces like the SEALs. And they said, when we went in 2001, our mission was clear. Defeat al-Qaeda, who they believed had some connection with the World Trade Center attacks of 9/11, and to remove the Taliban from power. And he said, at first we were welcomed as heroes and liberators and the people cheering us in the streets and the people were thrilled. And if they had left shortly after accomplishing the mission in 2002, say, they would have been remembered in the history books as the friends of Afghanistan. But they stayed. But they didn't just stay. They changed their mission. And the mission suddenly became, thanks to the Obamas of this world and so on, into nation building. That's what they called. But by nation building, they meant pushing a radical feminism, which doesn't go down too well in the average Islamic era, and then the LGBTQ gay agenda. And the Muslims, even Muslims who had welcomed the Americans as a relief from the Taliban, started to hanker back to the days of the Taliban when there was at least some moral standards. And the way it was described by reporters from Russia today, the Americans turned Kabul and Afghanistan into a place of bars and whorehouses and prostitutes and gambling and degeneracy, which they'd never known there before, and said, you know, even when the Russians were invaded, and they were there for 10 years, they didn't bring the kind of degeneracy or try to force on the people foreign ideas, which the local people reject as perversion. Well, so would Christians. But you can imagine how many Muslims were offended by this kind of agenda. So instead of just fighting terrorism, and removing Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, this nation building, which sounds nice, was actually promoting perversion, which was anti-family, anti-Christian, anti-Islamic, anti the local culture, and no wonder support for the government, which they perceived as not just corrupt but degenerate, was so total that in the end, many Afghans just stood by and did nothing when the Taliban overran the country.
Well, that is shocking and saddening to hear that these Americans who are meant to help are working against the morality of the country. The Taliban and he's taking over. What is behind that? What is his plans, and how did he manage to do it if Biden was so sure that he would not be able to?
Well, actually, there's a lot of hypocrisy and there's a lot of hidden agendas going on here. Because first of all, do you know that the Taliban's primary support base is Pakistan, which is a neighboring country? Now, Pakistan is a major American ally, and Pakistan gets vast amounts of aid for America every year, huge amounts. And in fact, a lot of high-tech American weaponry goes to Pakistan. But Pakistan is a primary supporter of the Taliban, and they provide most of the logistical support for the Taliban. But Pakistan is a nuclear power, and Pakistan's a major American ally. And so Obama put it clear to the president of Afghanistan, the one who just fled, said, in the strategic scheme of things, Afghanistan doesn't matter, but Pakistan matters. And he said, as far as America's concerned, Pakistan is our priority, Afghanistan's expendable. And so that is credible with witnesses, heard Obama, when he was president, saying that to the Afghan president, that, you know, you're really expendable and you're a sideshow. Pakistan's the main thing. And so America had a lot of options. They could have withdrawn or suspended or threatened to withdraw their huge amount of aid to Pakistan. They could have put a stop on aid. They could have put a stop on financial transfers. They could have put a stop on all kinds of economic benefits and trade things with Pakistan to force Pakistan to put pressure on the Taliban. But they never did. And this has been going on since Bush and Obama, all the way through to Biden. They have not put pressure on Pakistan to put pressure on the Taliban. And so basically, what's going on here is the chaos in Afghanistan, it's what the government wants, meaning that's what the US government wants. And that's the observation of people on the ground, including a South African reporter right there, who says this was predictable. Anyone could see what was going on. If America pulled out precipitously, abruptly like this, this was what was going to happen. It is a complete and utter destruction of confidence in America. America's credibility as a reliable ally has been shattered. And it's a devastating blow. I mean, who can trust a government who not only could abandon the ally, Afghan National Army and Afghan government, but even leave their own citizens and their own soldiers behind to fend for themselves and just withdraw everything necessary to do an orderly, safe evacuation of your forces? They didn't just betray the allies, they betrayed their own citizens. And who knows, if any of them get back to America, it'll not be thanks to the US government.
No. So if I have it right, the Taliban and Pakistan, they are
allies.
Allies. And then the Taliban, won't that be negative for America to have the Taliban ruling Afghanistan?
Well, it is negative to America and to America's interests worldwide. But it's not necessarily negative to the White House policy of the Democratic administration of President Biden right now, because after all, he inherited a strong economy from President Trump, where the price of fuel was way down, where America was self-sufficient energy-wise and didn't need to depend on imported oil for the first time in living memory, where they had the strongest border they'd ever had. And now in 7 months, America's in chaos. They have tripled the prices of fuel. The unemployment is suddenly going out of control. And they've got more than 1 million illegal migrants have flooded across the border in the last 7 months, many of them with COVID and other kind of diseases, many of them criminals, many of them gangsters. Who knows how many of them could be terrorists. And so he has turned a situation that was stable at the border into chaos. And this couldn't be just due to stupidity or foolishness or lack of planning. You've got to assume, as was said by, for example, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, nothing happens in politics by chance. If it happens, you can be sure it was planned to happen that way. Mm. And so taking that we've got to assume that these politicians, these Democrats, are not working for the good of the United States of America, but they are certainly not for the good of Afghanistan, but they're working for the good of the globalist agenda. This obviously is good for them in a sense that Vladimir Lenin, the Marxist revolutionary in Russia, said, never underestimate the power of constructive chaos.
Mm.
And so remember, if a person's an evolutionist or social Darwinist, they believe that the everything that you see came about from big explosion. Mm-hmm. So once upon a time there was nothing, and then there was something, and that something exploded for no reason, mm-hmm. and then it became everything. And so if you blow up enough things and you burn down enough things, paradise will come in as a result. And that is social Darwinism. That's Marxism. It's the idea that chaos, burning in the streets, rioting like BLM riots and so on, mm-hmm. out of that will come utopia, perfection. Mm-hmm. And so somehow or another, in their scheme of things, they're wanting this chaos because it's going to lead to a more of a globalist situation, which is what they want. They're breaking down nationalism mm-hmm. and they're building up internationalism. Perhaps they're wanting to create problems to have people turn to the UN or so on to try mm-hmm. and solve. Whatever they're thinking is, it's obviously bad and it's obviously mm-hmm. evil, and a lot of innocent people are suffering as a result.
So the more chaos the world is in, the more they can kind of gain and be secure in what
I
they
think
have.
So, in the sense that when people are fearful, they're willing to give up their freedoms mm. and trust in big government to do more. And so in many cases, you get these so-called governments creating the very problems that they then promise solutions for.
Wow, that's shocking. What stance should take a Christian? Should a Christian take towards this? Should we be involved in it? What should we think?
Well, first of all, I'm just thinking of the verse in 2 Chronicles 19, verse 2. 2 Chronicles 19, verse 2, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore, the wrath of the Lord is upon you. First and foremost, we should never want to compromise our faith. We can have nothing to do with treachery, betraying people, betraying trust, betraying confidences. It's just shocking. And of course, what's the basic golden rule of Christ? Love your neighbor, do to others as you want them to do to you. We wouldn't want to be abandoned. I mean, think, for 20 years, America's built up a whole generation of people to trust them. We're here to help you. Well, that's what they said. Mm. And of course, many of the people on the ground were there to help them. But they didn't make the decisions. The upper people now made this decision. You think of all the blood and sacrifice of American soldiers and how many civilians, missionaries, who've worked for the last 20 years to try and build Afghanistan up, to see it broken down like this at such an abrupt, very, very catastrophic situation and time, just with no real warning that this is coming. Mm. And so obviously, we've got to grieve, but we've got to learn, and we've got to see what can we do. But I think the biggest lesson we can learn from this is you cannot trust big government. In fact, anybody who trusts in politicians and government to solve their problems has not been paying attention to history.
Mm. Okay, and speaking about history, what role does that play, and what can we learn from history? Do you think it will repeat itself? What is the history of America with other countries and allies?
Well, I've had a lot of experience involved in missions, and in my 39 years in frontline and over 40 years of being a missionary all told, I've met a lot of key players in history. So one of the great leaders in Africa of the last century has been Jonas Savimbi. Jonas Savimbi was the veteran Angolan freedom fighter in Angola, the leader of UNITA. UNITA stood for the Union for the National Total Independence of Angola, UNITA. And his father was a great evangelist. His father planted churches. He was a railwayman, and he planted churches all along the Benguela railway line. Really a fine man. Well, Jonas Savimbi went off the trail as a youngster, went to China to train to be a terrorist, guerrilla, freedom fighter. And he came out of there disillusioned with communism and said, I learned in China how to fight a war, but how not to run a country. And he turned more back to the faith of his father as he came back to Angola, and he turned against the communists, and UNITA became a primary fighting force to fight against the communists, the Russians, the Cubans, and Marxism. He was fighting for free market and freedom of religion. I certainly only received good hospitality. He welcomed me in to preach to his men, to be a chaplain for them, to evangelize, and he was very friendly to the gospel. And I brought an American film crews and managed to get people to film their story and to interview Jonas Savimbi and get a story out around America. Well, in one of these morning breakfasts at Jonas Savimbi's table in Jumba, the headquarters of UNITA Freedom Fighters in Free Angola, Jonas Vimby said, "It is better to be America's enemy than America's friend. If you are America's enemy, you will probably be bought. But if you're America's friend, you will certainly be sold." Now, Jonas Vimby was by no means anti-American. In fact, he loved American history. He regularly would be quoting from George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, and he looked to America as a city on a hill, an example of faith and freedom and free enterprise that he hoped to emulate in Angola. But he was referring to the U.S. State Department and its trail of betrayal. And Jonas Vimby then leaned across the breakfast table and asked, "Do you know why there hasn't been a revolution in America for over 200 years? And the American guests with us were at loss to know how to answer the question. So Jonas Vimby laughed and he said, "There's no American embassy in America." And everyone squirmed and some laughed. And that actually isn't much of a joke. It's true. There's been a lot of involvement of American embassies inciting, fomenting, even organizing coup d'etats and revolutions all around the world. And it's been proven. Oil companies got the CIA to organize Operation Ajax, which orchestrated the 1953 coup d'etat, which overthrew the democratically elected prime minister in Iran in favor of an oil company choice of prime minister for Iran. I mean, that was disgusting. Well, next year, 1954, the CIA overthrew the president of Guatemala to establish a dictatorship which favored the American multinational American United Fruit Company. Well, in 1962, there was a coup d'etat organized in the Dominican Republic, organized by the CIA from the American embassy. And all of this was confirmed by the Church Commission in 1975. 1963, the South Vietnamese leader, who was meant to be America's ally, he got assassinated. And this was organized by Vietnamese generals who had requested the CIA's help to bring about this coup d'etat. In 1964, there was a coup d'etat in Brazil where the Brazilian chief of staff had contacted the CIA and got their help to overthrow the president of the country. And they stayed in power from 1964 till 1985. And President Lyndon Johnson planned this Brazilian coup with his advisors. I mean, these things have come out. And there's many books out, but one of them is The CIA's Black Ops, Covert Action, Foreign Policy and Democracy, published in the year 2000 by John Jacob Nutter. And, well, a friend of mine, a good friend, Ada Parker, she is a great journalist. Ada Parker in 1977 documented in the South African newspaper, The Citizen, that the American embassy reading room in Soweto, didn't anyone even know they had a reading room in Soweto? But using the American embassy as the cover, so it's American sovereign space, they were stocking books, pamphlets, magazines, and films, not of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and American free enterprise. No. Mao Tse-tung, Vladimir Lenin, Karl Marx, Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, other Marx revolutionaries. And Ada Parker documented how the U.S. Embassy was deliberately, under Jimmy Carter, fostering revolution and advancing communist aims in South Africa using their own embassy grounds. Now, embassies are not meant to be used to foment revolution in other countries, but they did in South Africa. So, yes, there's been a lot of examples of how the United States government has interfered in the political actions and brought about revolutions and coup d'etats, even of their allies.
That's shocking. And it seems like a lot of these state overthrows that they did was for gaining big companies, for gaining money, am I right?
Yeah, well, as one American president said, the business of America is business. And in many cases, it does look like big business, multinational companies, and the banksters, the banks are called cross between banker and gangster, banksters, they seem to pull the strings. And a lot of American administrations and governments do the bidding of these big multinational corporations. And just looking right now, how you can see how big tech and big pharma have managed to get big government to orchestrate the whole world to go into this lockdown for a virus that they concocted in a laboratory in Wuhan, China, man-made virus. And now you've got to get their vaccine that they produce. And this is making billionaires all over the place. There's 9 new billionaires in the world in the last 18 months as a direct result of the vaccines. Nine new billionaires. It's just staggering how much corruption is involved with big pharma, big business, and big tech covering for them, censoring any facts coming out from scientists and medical professionals that go against the narrative and discourage people from trusting in the government, believing in COVID, trusting in salvation by vaccination, and things like this. And the moment you question the COVID culture, you get shut down by new inquisition. And so, yes, it does look like, in many cases, big business doesn't just buy governments, but in some cases, they seem to own and control them.
Yeah, that's shocking. And looking at this business and even at COVID, at the State Department, seeing that there's a difference between America, freedom, and so on, and America, State Department, and politics, yes. How do we get people to think open-minded between the two, even about COVID? Yes.
Well, of course, there's many fine American individuals, and most American people would be horrified to know what their government has been doing, especially the State Department, because the U.S. State Department's actually been involved in a lot of treacherous things. One person I met in America, Captain Eugene McDaniels, known as Red McDaniels, because he's very tall, very red-headed. Mm-hmm. And so Red McDaniel, he's a naval captain, and he was shot down over Vietnam. And he wrote the book Scars and Stripes, the true story of one man's courage facing death as a POW in Vietnam. And I read the book and I met him, and he survived 6 years of torture in what they called the Hanoi Hilton, which is this horrible prison in Vietnam. And he became involved in after the Vietnam War, he became very involved in the campaign to bring back the other missing in actions, because America had left more than 2,000 missing in actions, unaccounted fors, who had not been returned. And so he campaigned for this, and he alerted me to the fact that it wasn't just Vietnam. The American government abandoned their prisoners, not just in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, thousands of them, to die rotting in the jungles in some communist prison hellhole. But they abandoned American prisoners, thousands of prisoners of war in North Vietnam, North Korea, and China after the Korean War. And also in the Soviet Union, American soldiers were involved in the First World War at Archangel in a secret op to try and counter the Reds, the Red Army. And then they were abandoned and thousands were left behind and ended up in the gulags. And tens of thousands of American prisoners, over 22,000, were in German prisoner of war camps, airmen shot down, things like that. And they were in areas that the Soviet Union captured. And so the Russians just kept them, put them into their gulags. So there were tens of thousands of Americans working in the Soviet Union's gulags, the concentration camps, as slave labor. I mean, this is while they're meant to be allies. And they didn't bother to return them to their people. And they used them for many years as blackmail, saying, if you don't do this, that, and the other, we will not return your prisoners. And after a while, it changed you. If you don't do this, that, and the other, we will let the world know that you've abandoned your prisoners for so many years in our hands, both of which would be disastrous to successive governments. And so this actually got evidence. It's documented. One of the books that Captain Red McDaniels pointed me to was Kiss the Boys Goodbye, How the United States Betrayed Its Own POWs, which documents it from the First World War onwards. And how many administrations, Woodrow Wilson's, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, Lyndon Johnson, Eisenhower, how they abandoned their own prisoners of war by the thousands. You know, it's bad enough to think that a country can betray its allies, but to betray its own soldiers?
Oh, that's shocking. And that's kind of what's happening right now as well. So from history, we basically see it repeating itself.
Yes, anyone who says trust in the government does not understand history.
Yeah, I know, that's shocking. So looking at what's happening in Afghanistan right now, and looking back to history, what do you think will happen, will follow after this?
Well, this is going to be catastrophic. And, of course, there actually should be an absolute outrage, a howl of outrage throughout America against this shocking treachery of government. This has got to be one of the worst debacles in living memory. Old enough to remember when America abandoned their ally in South Vietnam and the horrible scenes of people just trying to climb over the American embassy's fence and trying to grab onto the wings and onto even the helicopters that are trying to take off from top of the embassy buildings, and the South Vietnamese people pleading, take my baby. Imagine. And now we're seeing scenes in Afghanistan where there's mothers throwing their babies, imagine, over the barbed wire fence, to the other side asking Americans to take them. You know, they don't see any hope that they'll go, but, you know, just take my baby so my baby's not left behind to be brought up in the Taliban. Shocking scenes. People climbing onto the wheels of these big American transport jets taking off. And, of course, none of them survived. They can't. People falling off from thousands of feet above. Others actually trapped and dead in the wheel mechanism of the planes when they landed after evacuating. So the shocking scenes that you've just seen there, this is going to destroy many people. Who's going to trust America coming in saying, you know, we're going to help you, trust us? And so the damage done to America's credibility after the Vietnam debacle in 1975 was bad. But this is going to be worse because this is worse. And it's so totally unavoidable. And I would hope that the good people of America would rise up in outrage and bring their government to account and in every way they can replace them. The moment they've got any kind of elections and so on, they should remember how much fraud was involved to bring this particular group of gangsters and criminals into the White House. And honestly, if there's any justice in America, I would imagine that they should all be arrested for treason, and not just treason in what they've done against the national security of America with the border crisis and with what's gone on in Afghanistan, betraying the soldiers, but how they lied and cheated and stuffed ballot boxes and were involved in colossal fraud, which is being proved now. What they were dismissing as fake news 7 months ago is now proven by audits of the votes in places like Arizona. So there's no doubt that the government in the White House right now is illegitimate. It's got no legitimacy. And for Americans to try and pretend everything's okay, it isn't. People in Zimbabwe don't buy the lie that Mugabe or Mnangagwa or ZANU-PF won elections. They know it's fraud. And they don't pretend otherwise. And there should at least be an honesty of saying, we've got an illegitimate government who's there by fraud. And we know that in many parts of Africa, people know it. And they can say it openly. And they don't have to fear for their lives are being deplatformed for saying so, because we know and we recognize that's fraud. And so after the disaster of the 2020 elections in America, I said to some of my American friends with sympathy, I said, well, now you know what it's like to have a free and fair election. Because the United States State Department has been pushing on us what they call free and fair elections, just like this fraud, for how many decades now? And so now Americans sadly know what it's like to have what the State Department calls a free and fair election.
It seems like a lot of this news and this truth comes out months or even years later, like you told about the prisoners of wars. The news about that, the truth about that got exposed way, way, way after it actually happened. Don't you think that would happen here as well? Afghanistan is going to abandon their people. America is going to abandon their people in America, Afghanistan. And then the truth is going to come out about it later when people don't care anymore.
I'm sure that's what the government would like. They're hoping people are going to get distracted. And that's a lot of what the media does. It's been said before that whenever you see a big news story in the media, look around for the real story they're trying to distract you from. And a lot of what we get is distraction. In fact, in the Roman Empire, the emperors worked out that what you need to do is have a lot of bread and circuses. Give the people free bread and give the people circuses. Which by them they meant the Circus Maximus, the chariot races and the gladiatorial sports and the blood sports, and distract the people. And while they're distracting the people, people are losing their freedoms and the government's as corrupt as anything, and they are butchering other nations and plundering other countries. And the Roman Empire fell because of that kind of internal corruption. The people of Rome became decadent and they became corrupt and immoral and they didn't care. And Plato, 2,500 years ago, said, the price of apathy in politics is to be ruled by evil people. And that's what we're seeing. The price of liberty is eternal vigilance. If you want to be free, you need to be vigilant. You've got to hold your government to account. And if you say, oh, I'm not interested in politics. And I've met people in South Africa who arrogantly, proudly assert, I haven't voted in the last 20 years, or I've never voted. And they feel themselves morally superior. It's like those people that you meet who can smugly say, I don't belong to church. I haven't belonged to church in years or decades or ever. And they somehow think, oh, doing nothing and not being committed to a congregation or not voting, somehow or another, inactivity and passivity is more spiritual and more somehow morally superior. And yet, that's not what I see in the Bible. In the Bible, I see that we are condemned for sins of omission, not just sins of commission. Matthew 25, Day of Judgment, red letter, if you've got a red letter edition of the Bible. Jesus says, on the Day of Judgment, he will say to the goats on his left, you did not give water to the thirsty, you did not give food to the hungry, you did not give clothing to the naked, you did not visit those in prison for their faith, you didn't care for those who were sick. Depart from me, cursed lake of fire prepared for the devil and its angels. Now, that should be a shocking thing to read because they're not being condemned for something they did, but for something they did not do. And biblically, a big emphasis is to know the good we ought to do and not to do it. That is sin. And so the worst sin in many ways is apathy and neutrality and passivity, just doing nothing. And I'm afraid a lot of people are in that place, and many people feel good about it because they're so distracted watching TV programs and watching the news and watching sports that they don't notice what's happening to the schools and their children and their grandchildren and the churches and what's happening to society. We need to be involved, and we need to be good neighbors, and we're meant to care about other nations, even nations far away. We're to be a witness to the uttermost parts of the earth. Now, for missionaries like us, who are concerned for reaching the Muslim Middle East, we rejoiced throughout the 1980s to see how the Afghans, despite being invaded by the Soviet Union and despite being communist regime, the church grew and grew and grew. And so 10 years of communist Russian oppression in Afghanistan didn't kill the church. In fact, the church grew dramatically. Mm-hmm. And when Americans went in 2001 and removed the Taliban, the church grew even faster. And we're, this is great. But now, anyone who's converted in Afghanistan, their life's in danger. The Taliban are saying, you've got to reject Christianity. You've got to come back to Islam, or we're going to behead you and shoot you in the head and things like this. And, of course, most dedicated Christians in Afghanistan are considering fleeing. And that doesn't help win Afghanistan for Christ if the Afghan Christians flee the country and then the country is again without its Christian witness. Who's going to evangelize the rest? So the situation is what at one time looked like the gospel's advancing in Afghanistan. Now it's discredited. And you can understand Muslims who say, we reject Christianity because look what Christianity brought us. It brought us perversion and brothels and immorality and drunkenness and drugs and the gay agenda. And in one sense, they're right. But of course, that wasn't Christianity. Yeah. But many of them can't tell the difference between Western American corrupt, degenerate so-called civilization and biblical Christianity. And in some ways, you can understand why there's this misunderstanding. Because to them, the culture, the politics, and their religion is all the same. And yet Christians in the West, some are divided. But to think the sacrifice of so many American soldiers and the hard work of missionaries. And we've had, for example, Heather Mercer here at our mission, in our boardroom, taking devotions at our mission. And she was in 2001 in death row in Afghanistan, sentenced to death for the crime of showing the Jesus form on her laptop to four Muslims. And she was about to be killed by the Afghan, by execution, by firing squad, when the Americans came in and took over Afghanistan and freed her. And, you know, we were all rejoiced. Mm-hmm. And that was good. But all that sacrifice, it's like it's been destroyed by the treachery and the short-sightedness and the wickedness of the so-called nation-building that Obama brought in, where suddenly it was no longer about fighting terrorism and keeping America safe, but trying to force these poor Afghan people into a Western perversion, which they all reject and which we reject too.
Yeah. Well, that is really then, I think, a call to prayer for everyone, to pray for the Christians in Afghanistan, those who are considering fleeing, but also for the church, that it will stay preserved and purified through this even. How do you think the Christianity in the future look, and what is our role as missionaries and so on to Afghanistan and so?
Yes. So if you want to learn about how to pray for Afghanistan, first of all, go to Operation World. Operation World website, operationworld.org, and look up Afghanistan. If you've got the book, that's the best. You turn to Afghanistan and learn about the needs and to pray for that country. This is This is a great country, and this is a tough country. This is a rough, rugged, mountainous country. They frustrated Alexander the Great. He was conquering everything, but Afghanistan, rough. The British struggled to conquer Afghanistan. They had three horrible wars there, and it was a debacle because the British army, they might go in and win a battle, but they couldn't subdue the whole country, and they had to withdraw. The Soviet Union didn't manage either. And now the American Empire has also found that Afghanistan is a tough nut to crack. And what a pity. They started as liberators and ended up as occupiers and oppressors and as corruptors in the minds of the local people. And that's so sad because that's not, I'm sure, what most of the soldiers fought for. I'm sure many of the people on the ground feel betrayed by Biden and by what has been done. I know that the British feel very betrayed. In fact, the harshest words ever heard for their American ally was uttered on the floor of the British House of Commons in this last week on the treachery and the betrayal and how they've been treated and how disgusted they are by the evasive, dishonest, hypocritical speech by Biden, which basically blames everyone except himself and doesn't take any responsibility and blames allies and blames, even besmirches the memory of the soldiers. And as they said, you know, he's got no right to criticize people who've not put themselves in harm's way, have no right to criticize those who did who self-sacrificially fought to try and bring freedom to this country. And then you've got some politician far away besmirching and slandering their memory. And so the British, and you could hear hears across the whole of the House of Commons on both sides, government and opposition. There's, I don't know that America has been as held in contempt since the days of Obama or Carter, or you can go back to some of the other lowlifes who've betrayed countries like FDR, betraying the whole of Eastern Europe at the Yalta Agreement into the hands of Stalin, Soviet Union, betraying Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary and all these countries. And I've traveled throughout Eastern Europe and I've been these places, and to hear from people in Poland how betrayed they felt by the Western allies who first said they were fighting a war to protect them and then ended up by handing them over to the worst mass-murdering anti-Christian dictator ever, Stalin. And the betrayal of Hungary, 1956, the betrayal of Czechoslovakia, 1968, where the Americans encouraged them to rise up and fight. And when they did, they got no aid. Mm-hmm. I've spoken to people in Ukraine who said, do you know, we had combat units up to company strength fighting for 10 years after the Second World War against the Red Army in the field. Companies, I mean, that company is about 120-odd men. They were fighting. And in Lithuania, they were fighting till 1955, 10 years after the war. Also, the Forest Brothers of Lithuania fighting the Red Army. And they said, we kept waiting for the Americans to come and help us. Mm. And we had no idea. They had no intention. We thought that they meant what they promised and said, you know, fighting for liberation and freedom and against tyranny and all this thing. And they were listening to Radio Free Europe and they were doing what they thought they were being encouraged to do by the American allies, but no aid ever came. And that's just, you could just imagine the betrayal these people felt. And then the Katahdin Forest Massacre and all of that comes out and you find out the Americans knew about it. FDR, the president of America, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and his main solution to the problem was to contact Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of Britain, to get rid of Prime Minister Władysław Sikorski, General Sikorski, who is the head of the Polish government in exile, who was asking uncomfortable questions about their ally, the Soviet Union, who had just killed all the Polish officers and NCOs, the entire leadership structure of Poland. And so the solution was on the 4th of July in 1943 to assassinate the Polish government leader and his entire cabinet with his daughter. And that the Poles still feel strongly. I mean, they still remember this, the fact that their wartime allies, Britain and America, organized for the elimination of the entire government in exile because they wanted to protect the Soviet Union's reputation from being exposed as the culprits in the Katahdin massacre. And so they rather attributed it to the enemies who couldn't defend themselves, and they murdered their allies in order to cover it up. And of course, you can't bury the truth for too long. Mm. It might take a generation or two, but these things all come out.
Yeah. Well, and so with knowing this, how America has treated, or not America, but those leaders,
American government, State Department,
State Department has treated the people they were meant to help, and then encourage them to go into the fight and then just leave them there. You're on your own now. What should Christians do? Christians who are in government, Christians who want to maybe go into State Department, or even us who think, okay, I don't want to get involved in government, in politics, because that's what it looks like.
Yes.
How do we keep away from giving up hope, basically?
Well, I mean, the first and foremost is to be right with God and to learn to fear God. If we fear God, we won't fear man. Jesus said, don't fear man who can only kill the body and after that do nothing else. Fear God who can destroy both body and soul in hell forever. That's whom you should fear. Fear God. So we need to learn the fear of God. And if we learn the fear of God, we will be freed from the fear of man. That's the first thing. And then to get back to the Bible and pray the Psalms. When I've come across treachery like this, and when I've come across the hideous stories from some of these prisons of war and what they were tortured and sent to Jeremiah Denton and Captain Red McDaniels and others, what they went through in Vietnam and what I've experienced and what I've seen others experience, Rwanda and others. Well, we go to the Psalms. We pray the Psalms of justice, praying for God to intervene. And this is therapeutic. This is right. This is healthy. We cannot live with bitterness. Mm-hmm. We need to turn to and put our trust in the eternal judge. Our creator will do right. There's a day of judgment coming. And those who seem to escape justice on earth will not escape justice in eternity. There will be a day of reckoning, and there is a day of judgment. And the day will come when it's appointed unto man wants to die, and after that the judgment. Everyone will give an account of their lives. And those who have not surrendered their lives to Christ, repented of their sins, and found faith and freedom in Christ, they will have to answer for their own crimes and sins. And it'll be a dreadful day, as we know, as the book of Revelation exposes. And then we need to be part of the solution. So God has given us all a task. The Lord has called us. Who will rise up for me against the wicked? Who will make a stand for me against the workers of iniquity? Mm-hmm. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. And so we call to be salt and light in society. Mm-hmm. And as such, we can all do something to make the world better. We've got to love our neighbor as ourselves. We've got to do to others we want to be done unto. And as such, this means, first of all, truth. What's the first weapon? What's the first item in the full armor of God? The belt of truth. Mm-hmm. The belt of truth is so important. Jesus said, you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free. And so programs like this from the front line, we're trying to make known truth, to expose the darkness and the lies. And so we need to remember light is more powerful than darkness. And truth is more powerful than lies. Mm-hmm. And the word of God is more powerful than all of Satan's tricks and schemes. And this was the symbol of the Leipzig prayer meeting, which brought down the Iron Curtain and the Berlin Wall. In East Germany and Leipzig, they would gather together with unlit candles, and one would be lit, and then they'd share from one to the other. And as it spread, it was, our light is more powerful than darkness. Not all the darkness of communism and atheism could put out the smallest candle. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I might only have one little light, but my light is more powerful than the darkness. And so we've got to be salt and light in society. And I do believe that as Christians, as we do our various duties as parents, as bringing up children, raising them in the fear of the Lord, teaching people the Word of God, running a Bible study group, whether it's at home or at school or in a workplace or in a college, Bible study and prayer fellowships, being light, supporting our local congregations, building and expanding new congregations, all of this is all part of the campaign to fight against the lies and the deception and the treachery of this world and those who are seeking to serve Satan's globalist agenda.
Mm. Oh, and such a beautiful imagery about the light. And it got me thinking about a quote we just heard last week saying the only way that darkness can overcome light is if light denies itself. Mm. And so this is certainly a call to action. We should not deny ourselves, but rather let the light shine. And so what is ways, I know about the upcoming prayer, IDOP. Could you tell more about that?
Yes. So we're trying to encourage people to pray for the persecuted church. We have a website dedicated to it, IDOP-Africa, mm-hmm. IDOP, short for International Day of Prayer. And so this is the main focus for mobilizing churches to pray for the persecuted church. Of course, we would like churches to be praying for the persecuted, such as in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. Every day of the year, if possible, but at least to focus a Sunday a year. And so the second Sunday of November of every year, we seek to mobilize people to pray for the persecuted church. And so this year, that's going to be the 14th of November. And we've got a website, so visit either the Frontline Mission SA.org website or IDOP-Africa.org, and you'll find a lot of good resources, PowerPoints, links, videos, updates, news, to be able to speak up for the persecuted. And so I think this is, we've got to think of the casualties of the short-sightedness and treachery of politicians who've got a globalist agenda. And if you go onto our Frontline Mission SA.org website, you'll see documentation on a lot of what we're talking here, like Freedom Betrayed, The Secret History of World War II and Its Aftermath, written by President Herbert Hoover, and How Capitalists Saved Communism from Collapse, and Death by Government and the Greatest Killer, and The Black Book of Communism. There's a whole lot of resources that we've put together to help people to speak on this and share this program. Let's do what we can. Let's speak up for those that we can speak up for. And when it comes time to vote, let's make sure that we vote, because, do you know, more people are eligible to vote who don't register to vote, or who can vote but who don't vote, than those who actually do vote. So most of the people out there are saying, what difference can my vote make? But in fact, if we could get those people who somehow are disengaged into it, they can make all the difference.
Yeah, that's true. So let us let our light shine, pray for the persecuted church, and pray for Afghanistan. And take up the call to action. I'm going to close with Psalm 94, verse 16. Who will rise up for me against the evildoers? Who will stand up for me against the workers of iniquity? And so may we be those Christians who do that, and we choose to love and put feet to that love, and not just, not be light that gets defeated, but rather that shine in the darkness. So God bless and have a good day.